Paying for college has never seemed more daunting. The number one box office movie the last two weekends, 21, dramatizes a group of MIT students who decide to try to relieve some tuition pressures by hitting the gaming tables in Las Vegas. Now they have a system imparted by their professor, played by Kevin Spacey.
We had a total of 76 cards that came out of the deck. 23 were high cards with a value of minus one. 17 were neutral with no value at all, and the rest were low cards with a value of plus one. How could you lose the count?
Plus 13, the count.
Yes. Pull up a chair.
That's Kevin Spacey and Jim Sturgis. We've asked our own card shark, our math guy Keith Devlin, to pull up his chair. Keith, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
You know, some people go to the movies for the stars. We sent you for the math. Does it add up?
The math adds up. In fact, the math portrayals in the movie, they actually get it right. And it's all based on two cases in the mid-1990s. There were actually, I think at one stage, 100 or so teams of MIT students who would regularly go out to Vegas to play the casinos. They took a method for basically for beating the casinos at blackjack that had been invented way back in the early 1960s by a then MIT professor of mathematics, Edward Thorpe. They then, in the course of the 80s and 90s, refined that method so that it was actually a surefire thing. They were no longer gambling if they played that method. They were guaranteed that over many hours of play, and the movie doesn't make that part clear, you will make a very, very good profit.
It's kind of made to look easy in this film, I gather.
The method itself is extremely simple. It's not a matter of counting numbers of cards or adding up the totals. As the movie makes very clear, you have this simple number that you carry in your head. You, whichever way you set it up, you add one if it's lots of low cards. When low cards come out, you subtract one when high cards come out. And the point is that because of the way blackjack is played in casinos, when the proportion of high cards, nines, tens, face cards, is high, the player has an edge over the casino, so that if you play many, many times, you can win. So Thorpe introduced this idea of a single number that you just adjust with every player by either adding one or subtracting one or leaving it as it is, and carrying that in your mind. And then when the number tells you there's a large number of face cards in the deck, you start to bet increasing amounts of money. The problem is, although the arithmetic is simple, you have to do it in a noisy casino over many, many hours when you're getting tired, and knowing that there are cameras in the ceiling that are looking at you, and if they detect that you are concentrating on something other than the game, two very large gentlemen with baseball, well, they won't have baseball bats, but two very large gentlemen will come along and escort you out of the establishment.
The process you describe, is that essentially what very gifted blackjack players do?
You certainly need to be very good at instant arithmetic and have a good focus to be able to carry that count. I tried it once as an experiment, not in a casino.
I was just working my way up to that question. All right, yeah.
And it's extremely easy to lose track of that count. Most of the people that have tried this, and when Thorpe's book came out in the early 60s, thousands of people tried it, and hardly any of them were successful because it's incredibly difficult to carry that number and remember it. And that clip you played from the movie is accurate in it. It shows that it takes a very unusual individual to make it look as though you're actually just being lucky, whereas in fact you're doing mathematics all the time on every single hand.
Keith, thanks so much. Nice talking to you.
Okay, my pleasure, Scott.
Keith Devlin, our math guy, speaking to us from Stanford University. This is music from the new film, The Visitor, which opens this weekend. The combination of this spare classical piano and the rhythmic West African drum is like a summary of The Visitor's plot. The main characters are an immigrant from Syria, whose big passion in life is his girlfriend, and drumming, and a straight-laced older white man who learns to let go through music. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, The Visitor shows what can happen when two people from different worlds come together.
Walter Vail is a global economics professor at a college in Connecticut. He's a widower whose late wife was a concert pianist. He's trying to connect with his grief by taking piano lessons himself.
Don't flatten. Make room for the train.
And not getting very far.
Learning an instrument at your age is difficult, especially if you don't possess a natural gift for it.
That doesn't help Walter's already sullen mood. He goes to his old apartment in New York City and finds a young immigrant couple living there through a real estate scam. Eventually, they become friends, especially Walter and the boyfriend, Tarek, a Syrian who plays the West African drum, the djembe. Tarek teaches Walter to play.
Walter, I know you're a very smart man, but with a drum you have to remember not to think. Thinking just screws it up, okay?
Okay.
Now give it a couple of bangs. Not so hard. You're not angry at it.
Okay. I'm sorry.
The contrast between the drum and the piano is almost a metaphor for what happens to Walter through the course of The Visitor, says screenwriter Tom McCarthy.
Here's a guy who starts off with an interest in classical piano, and obviously is tied into his wife, who has since passed away. And it's his journey from this sort of, at least at this point, this heady instrument that he can't seem to get the hang of, to this African drum, to the djembe. It's sort of the difference in instruments. I mean, the drum is something you don't even have to be good at it. It can just be a sort of cathartic experience. You can really commit to it.
But first, you have to learn to play it.
I actually never touched the drums in my life, but maybe the singing helped me a little bit with the rhythm and the timing.
Actor Haz Sleiman, who's originally from Lebanon, says it was easy to connect with his character.
Tarek's path, like, he moved from Syria to Michigan and then from Michigan to New York to pursue music, and I did exactly the same, only like from Lebanon to Michigan and then to New York to pursue a career as a recording artist. So I thought that was like one of those things where you think like the planets are aligned in some way.
To learn how to play the djembe, Sleiman spent several weeks taking daily lessons from a professional musician from Ghana. What was the first thing you learned on the drum? And I'd love if you could demonstrate.
It's pretty much actually the beat that I teach Richard in that scene. So that would be it. It's a very simple beat, as you can tell.
Some might say deceptively simple. Good drummers make it sound easy. But Richard Jenkins, who plays Walter, the older white guy, says he played drums for about 5 years when he was a teenager and never felt he played well.
I never got out of my head as a drummer. You know, I was still always counting, and I wasn't getting any better, so I stopped.
Richard Jenkins says he, too, has a lot in common with his character. He says he's not very adventurous and needs to be pushed to try new things. In The Visitor, music has a freeing quality for Walter Vail, like when the young Tarek insists that he listen to the Afropop star Fela Kuti. Tomorrow, tomorrow, my soul.
And when I saw the film, I could almost see me relax when the fella music started.
Throughout The Visitor, Walter Vail often looks like a fish out of water. In one scene, he musters up enough courage to play in a drum circle in New York City's Central Park. With his button-down shirt and tie and a tense look on his face, he sits in a line of musicians, all looking joyful, dressed in African clothes or T-shirts and jeans. But once he starts playing, Walter blends right in. In many ways, The Visitor is a movie about taking a leap of faith, whether it's moving to a new country, befriending someone from a different class or culture, or learning a new instrument. Screenwriter Tom McCarthy says to take that leap, you need to get out of your comfort zone.
I think the key is always, honestly, as Tarek's character says in the film, to get out of your head. Don't think. So I think this movie has a little bit about music allowing someone to drop down out of their head and into their body and into their life.
But that doesn't mean things end up well for any of the characters in The Visitor. It's also a story about the precarious existence of immigrants in America. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
And Tom McCarthy talks about researching immigration and the composer whose music he used in The Visitor at npr.org/movies.
If you're like me, you lost your appetite for fava beans and wine when you heard this.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Ugh. That, of course, is Anthony Hopkins bringing Dr. Hannibal Lecter to life in the movie The Silence of the Lambs. Lecter was born in the mind of crime novelist Thomas Harris, but it was Hopkins who made Hannibal the Cannibal one of the most notorious villains in American pop culture. As part of our series In Character, NPR's Laura Seidel explores how Lecter feeds our fascination with serial killers.
When Anthony Hopkins was first offered the part of the murdering psychiatrist Dr. Hannibal Lecter, he was intrigued.
I thought, oh, it's one of those parts. It's the dark man, the boogeyman at the top of the stairs, which we're all, you know, we all have that from our childhood fantasies, the unknown shadowy person, which is very attractive and erotic as well. But I thought, it's one of those parts, and I think I'm going to enjoy this.
I did not kill him, I assure you. Merely tucked him away very much as I found him after he'd missed 3 appointments.
But if you didn't kill him, then who did, sir?
Who can say? Best thing for him, really. His therapy was going nowhere.
Lecter is dark, but he's also funny. Hopkins co-star Jodie Foster, who played FBI profiler in Training, Clarice Starling, says she found Hopkins' portrayal frightening, but it was more than that.
He still played the wit of Hannibal Lecter. He played all of the layers of hiding. Instead of trying to, you know, understand whether his parents beat him or whether he was abused as a child, or, you know, instead of trying to make us feel sorry for him, he allowed Hannibal to have that veneer of evil.
And evil he is. Fortunately, in The Silence of the Lambs, Dr. Hannibal Lecter is already in prison for his crimes. This once-respected psychiatrist has killed at least 7 people and eaten them. Hence his nickname, Hannibal the Cannibal. Adding to his dark veneer is his home in a dungeon-like cell with no windows in the basement of a mental institution. In most of the film, we see Lecter through the eyes of Agent Clarice Starling, who is sent to get some information from Lecter to help catch another serial killer. Clarice is clearly frightened of him, and yet he takes a mentor-like attitude towards her.
Well, perhaps you'd care to lend us your view on this questionnaire, sir.
No. You were doing fine. You had been courteous and receptive to courtesy. You had established trust with the embarrassing truth about Miggs. And now this ham-handed segue into your questionnaire.
Hopkins has the capacity to just draw you in.
Dr. Helen Morrison is a psychiatrist who has studied serial killers.
Which is a little similar to what a serial killer can do. They draw you in, and then it's like being in a Venus flytrap. It's over.
Plenty of real-life research is behind Hannibal Lecter. Author Thomas Harris was a crime reporter who covered some real serial killers before he wrote The Silence of the Lambs. Anthony Hopkins studied up on them before he played the part. Morrison thinks Hopkins nails certain behaviors and characteristics of the real thing. She has interviewed dozens of them, including Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and Wayne Williams. Morrison says they can be alluring because they seem so normal. She remembers the first time she met a serial killer.
And I walked into the interview room, and there was this individual sitting there in a powder blue suit. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. I wonder when they're going to bring the serial killer in. And until I realized that this individual sitting in front of me, who looked like Casper Milquetoast, was responsible for some fairly horrendous murders.
Only once in the film do we actually see Lecter at his most murderous. One moment he's quietly sitting in a temporary cell listening to Bach's Goldberg variations and preparing to eat a lamb chop dinner served by the guards. The next moment, he has broken free of his handcuffs and he eats one of them and clubs the other to death. Throughout, there's no change in his placid expression. But Agent Starling never sees Lecter at his worst. To her, he appears human, and she treats him that way. A sort of bond develops between them. In a strange way, they relate to each other, says Jodie Foster. Lecter is locked away and treated like a lab rat by his jailer. Starling grew up poor and has worked her way up.
She wants dignity, and interestingly, Lecter does too. That's his little thorn in his side is he wants to be treated with dignity. And if you don't, he'll eat you.
Because of her unique relationship with Lecter, the character, Clarice Starling, comes to feel that he wouldn't attack and eat her. Indeed, when the movie ends, Clarice has caught the serial killer she was out to get, and Lecter has escaped. But he does make a brief phone call to Clarice and a promise.
I have no plans to call on you, Clarice. The world's more interesting with you in it. So you take care now to extend me the same courtesy.
You know I can't make that promise.
I do wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner.
Lecter is more than just a bad guy.
He is a fully fleshed character. You know, he's not just a cardboard villain. You see his vulnerabilities. You see that he cares for her in the way that he can, that he has a kindness towards her. And yes, we're seduced by that humanity, by his light touch with her, in the way that you would hope a great dad would be.
She must be kidding. And that's also where Hannibal's character serves the needs of fiction, says Dr. Morrison.
In real life, he never would have become attached to her. You know, I sit with these serial killers for 8-10 hours at a time, and I come back day after day after day, and every time I walk into them, it's as if I were starting all over again.
Morrison says actual serial killers have no empathy, but in Lecter, we get a little sweetness that may be what makes him better fiction and more likable and more enduring. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
The Rolling Stones are not the only senior citizens out there singing rock and roll, and to prove it, a new documentary film opens today. It's called Young at Heart. Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan says it's a great show.
The Young at Heart Chorus is a 24-member singing group from Northampton, Massachusetts. Average age, 80. Under the direction of Bob Sillman, these folks spend their golden years singing songs from groups like the Talking Heads, the Clash, and Coldplay. They even take a crack at a James Brown classic.
And yours is just like I knew that I would. Okay. You do that like I knew that I would.
Like I knew that I would.
You know what? Right. But you know what? Stan.
This may sound like a glib musical gimmick, but the reality is surprising. For what the members of this chorus lack in pure ability, they make up for in irrepressible spirits and a desire to simply have fun. When, for instance, 92-year-old Eileen Hall rips into the Clash's Should I Stay or Should I Go, age hardly matters. The frame of Young at Heart is a 7-week pre-concert rehearsal period, during which the chorus is expected to learn some quite difficult stuff, including Sonic Youth's Unsettling, Schizophrenia, and Alan Toussaint's Yes We Can, which uses the word can a memory-challenging 71 times. In an organization with members this old, the question of mortality inevitably comes up.
May your hands be always busy. May your feet be always swift.
When the chorus sings Bob Dylan's Forever Young to an audience at Hampshire Jail at a particularly emotional moment, many of the inmates are literally moved to tears. The age of these singers is not some contrivance, but the heart of the matter. In a culture that venerates youth, these people, having the time of their lives, near the end of their lives, couldn't be more refreshing. We want them to go on singing forever, most of all, perhaps, because we know there's no way they can.
The movie is Young at Heart. Kenneth Turan interviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
In the course of talking about the news over the next few days, I'm sure we'll mention a few people who are more famous than our next guest, the Pope, the Dalai Lama, President Bush. But it's a small circle, because Jackie Chan is a truly global phenomenon, a Hong Kong stuntman turned action movie star, an on-screen master of martial arts who provides his own comic relief. Chan's new movie, The Forbidden Kingdom, marks a momentous first-time collaboration, Jackie Chan and Jet Li,
Think Jagger and Dylan doing an album of duets. The movie can pretty much be summed up as The Wizard of Oz with lots of martial arts set in a mythic ancient China. A jade warlord is the wizard, an American teenage boy from Boston is Dorothy, and Jackie Chan's drunken master is, I suppose, a very courageous lion. Jackie Chan came to our West Coast studio to talk about the movie, his early school years in Hong Kong, and the long-held secret of his father's life.
And that time my father was 80-something. Right. I was driving in the car, then suddenly he turned around, son, I'm really scared. One day I sleep, I never wake up. Mm-hmm. That's some secret I want to tell you. I was surprised, what? And I said, don't tell me right now. Let me do something. Then I call my director. I called the two very good documentary director with the cameraman, with all the lighting.
You mean you didn't know what the secret was, but you brought in the whole crew to film your father at age 80?
You know, for the last couple of years, I hear a little bit, and the rumor, everybody have a past. Okay, if he don't want to talk about it, I don't want to ask.
Okay, but now he's ready to tell you.
He's ready to tell me. So this is why I set up the whole crew. I listen. Then I'm so surprised. After the whole interview, then I said, I hired the director. I said, look, please go to the China, find everything truth. Then he spent 3 years one by one to interview. Then I realized my father was a spy from Taiwan. That's a long, long story.
Yeah, but take me back. I mean, your father was spying for Taiwan for...
Against China.
Against China. And what kind of position did he hold that he was able to get information?
I don't know.
Don't know, huh?
Yeah, that I don't know.
But it was bad enough for him to flee to Hong Kong at some point.
Yes, yes, yes.
And you were born there.
Yes, I was born there until I was 6 and a half. Then my father moved to Australia.
Yeah, I read that your father was working. Was he a cook for an embassy in Australia?
American embassy.
Really?
American embassy for more than 20 years.
And you were sent away at some point to go to school, I gather.
Yes, I sent to the Marshall Opera School.
Marshall Opera School.
Yeah. How do you say you have to learn singing, dancing, musical, acrobatic, kicking, punch, stick fighting, all kind of things?
You see, that's the interesting combination, which obviously is what you've been doing your whole adult life, which is the mix of acting, dancing and singing, and martial art for stick fighting and kung fu.
I don't know what I'm doing. And when I was young, I just no future, I no hope. I just training every day. Every day I just play, oh God, please don't hit me. Tell the teacher, don't hit me. Then suddenly, when I was 7, becoming a child actor, then later on becoming a stuntman, low-class stuntman, then later on becoming a stunt coordinator, step by step, all my life in the film business.
Now, let me ask you a question, because in your new movie, in the Forbidden Kingdom, an American kid learns kung fu in a relatively short time. This is not a realistic movie, but it's what happens in The Karate Kid and a variety of many other movies where somebody masters a great skill. What was it actually like mastering the skills of martial arts when you were a
that's
kid?
That's very painful.
Painful.
Yeah. In our day, we don't have a rule. We just get up 5 o'clock in the morning, training whatever teacher tell you to training. 1,000 punch, 1,000 kick.
How old were you?
6 and a half in that time.
6 and a half?
Yeah, and sometimes have no reason. Because one people do something wrong, he hit the whole class, the teacher. Not like this day.
Yeah, no.
And they can sue you.
Yes, exactly. I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, did any of the kids quit or did their parents take them out of the school?
They quit. They ran out of school, escaped the school. Then suddenly you wake up, they disappear. Then I want to disappear. I want to go away.
Yeah.
But my parents was in Australia.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Where should I go? Nowhere to go.
Right.
So a lot of people go away. The teacher catch him back. Big punishment. Bah, 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 bah. Then I said, oh, where am I going? No money, nothing. Well, I have to stay in school for 10 years.
For 10 years doing this.
Yeah.
How much of what you learned back then is what we see you doing in a movie like The Forbidden Kingdom?
I think almost everything.
Everything.
Really, really. Because the writer, he's a big fan of mine. He's reading all my books, reading all my movies. Then he loved Chinese culture. So this is why he can write this kind of script.
Two legendary warriors, an orphaned girl and a lost traveler, must unite to save the kingdom.
In the center of this movie, in the middle of it, there's a scene between which you and Jet Li fight.
Yeah, yeah.
I won't give away the outcome of the fight, but it seems to go on for at least 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Is that possible?
It's just non-stop fighting.
Non-stop fighting.
Yeah, I remember the first day I fight with Jet Li. Then the stunt coordinator, okay, can you take a look? We're both standing here to see two stunt guys to show us the action sequence about like 10, 5 punch, 2 kick, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then after, I said, show me one more time. Then I said, oh, twice already. I said, okay, let's shoot without rehearsal. Then I turn around, look at Jet Li. Jet Li, okay, let's do it. Then we're just rolling the pa 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 pa. Wow, feeling so good.
How long did it take to actually shoot that fight scene?
Almost 1 week.
And I would imagine that just a few seconds would be a shot. I mean, to get that right, you would be.
Sometimes they spend a lot of time to choreograph how to make me and Jack looks good.
I would imagine that if I were the producer, I'd be watching all these scenes very, very carefully, hoping that neither of you injures himself during it.
We okay, because we are not like used to be making American film. The good thing is that there's so many protection. Everything, making American film, they so care about the actor.
In the American films, they care about the actor.
Yeah. Well, the Hong Kong film, we don't.
They don't care at all.
We don't, yeah. So this is why when I'm making my old film with so many injuries,
yeah,
we save time, save money, and risk life for the movie. But American film is no. They can waste a lot of time. They can spend a lot of money. But the actor, the people, the worker is more important.
You know, when you began talking with me, you were telling me about your father's secret life, which he shared with you when he was 80.
Yeah.
I read that you lost your father.
Yes,
last
month.
Last month.
Yes.
And he was already well into his 90s, I gather.
93.
Remained close to your parents throughout your
life? Yeah, very, very.
Really.
Especially after I know my parents, how tough they are to helping me, you know, for my future. Before I hate them. Why leave me in Hong Kong by myself? Everybody have a parents every week to come to see the son. Everything mm-hmm. they bring a food, but what about me?
They're off in Australia. They weren't.
Yeah,
they weren't coming
Australia.
To see you. Yeah.
Until one day I realized they worked so hard. Then I'm very getting close to my parents. Travel with my father all the time. Mm-hmm. Whenever I go to make a movie, I bring my father along.
Really?
Yeah.
Jackie Chan, thank you very much for
talking with us.
Thank
you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Jackie Chan's new movie with Jet Li is called The Forbidden Kingdom.